Ernie Pyle, his writings, and his death. That's our focus on this broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
All for something special, something that's just a little out of the ordinary on the Saturday night party. Today, April 18th, 1953, is an anniversary. A sad anniversary, I'm afraid, for the thousands of friends that Ernie Pyle had. For today is the 8th anniversary of his untimely death. Only 3 days before, this brilliant GI journalist met his fate at the hands of a Jap machine gunner on a Pacific island. Our own George Ramsby met him in a mail shack on Guam, where the two of them were awaiting transportation.
That's right, Bill. There we were, just a couple of guys from Indiana, a long way from home. Ernie was waiting for a ride to Aishima, and I was going the other way with Eddie Peabody's entertainment unit. I don't remember what we talked about, but I could see right off that he was a real guy. And from that short meeting way out there in the South Pacific, I understood at once why Ernie Pyle was loved and respected by everyone, GIs and the folks back home alike. And I'm proud to have a part in this tribute to him. A tribute made up of music, narration, and a special ballad I'll sing depicting the course of his life, all woven together in a salute to a great American. A salute to Ernie Pyle. It begins with an American song, back home again in Indiana. This is fitting because Ernie Pyle was born in Indiana, but the music must change. It must encompass the Rocky Mountains and the desert, and it must sing of the West and of stars painted in a sky free of clouds, and of the South, too. Of cotton fields and bayous, of magnolia blossoms and of tobacco fields. Yes, let the music tell of a great land, of north and south and east and west, for Ernie Pyle was a traveling minstrel who sang of this great land and of the people who lived in it. Here was a modern Johnny Appleseed who wandered from border to border and planted words that grew into pictures of the America he found so beautiful. Here was a weaver of words, a man who dipped his pen in the fragrance of apple blossoms in the state of Washington and cherry blossoms in the state of Michigan. A man who listened to the crackle of growing corn on a hot July night in Iowa and breathed deep of the sea on the coast of Maine. This was a man who loved the land and the people who lived on it, the everyday people, the garage mechanics and the bellhops, the waitresses and the store clerks, the factory workers and the bus drivers, the everyday people who were called up to leave what they were doing, to leave the America they loved, because there was a war to be fought and won. Ernie went to war too, went to war to write about his friends, these same everyday people. He lived with them and ate with them and slept with them. He shared their joys and their sorrows, and he shared their dangers, and he finally died with them. He belonged to them. He belonged to the G.I. Joes of the infantry, the artillery, the armored divisions, the Navy, the Marines, the Army Air Forces. To each, he devoted his heart, his mind, and his words. He told their stories so that their families and their friends back home would know how they lived and what they thought and what they hoped. Some men have been eulogized by great orations, others in ponderous books and tomes, and still others have been memorialized in marble and stone But we feel a much simpler thing befits a guy like this. A simple thing like a ballad, a voice, a guitar, and maybe a few wistful strings added here and there. Yes, a ballad is the thing called for here. The Ballad of Ernie Pyle. Oh, hear this tale about a little guy. Oh, hear this tale about a little guy. His first home was the Hoosier State. He soon claimed all the 48. This citizen whose name was Ernie Pyle. He wasn't much to look at, it is true. Was bald and thin and eyes of bluest blue. A peaceful gent who hated wars. His heart was big as all outdoors. This little guy who every GI knew. Oh, Ernie Pyle was quite a traveling man. Oh, Ernie Pyle was quite a traveling man. From capital to county seat, the entire nation was his beat, and every fellow human was a friend. Pearl Harbor came and Ernie went to war. He went to join the friends he'd made before. The little guys became GIs. He saw the war from out their eyes. He was the soldier's wandering minstrel man. Out in New Mexico he bought a home. For when the war was over he'd not roam. He planned that home with love and care. He wanted him a life right there. He didn't know he wasn't coming home. He joined our boys on Africa's far shores. He joined our boys on Africa's far shores. Marched all day, then rode till dawn to tell us folks just what went on. This peaceful little man who hated wars. Oh, Ernie went to France when D-Day came. But now he found the war had burst its frame. His heart and mind were sick from hate. He'd seen and lived too much of late. And so he sailed for home where life was sane. Oh, home was so much velvet for this man. You eat and sleep at will, not when you can. And after many months at home, our Ernie got the itch to roam. His thoughts were with our boys on foreign sand. This time he joined the Navy on the sea. This time he joined the Navy on the sea. He stopped off in the Philippines to laud the Navy and Marines. He soon moved on to sing of G.I. Joe. Our song will end in just a little while. We landed next upon a tiny isle. Too small to show on most of the maps. A little isle that's swarmed with Japs who struck him down. Our pal, our Ernie Pyle. And when he breathed his last, this minstrel brave, they turned the earth and made a hero's grave. Within the sound of ocean tide, with other heroes by his side, taps blew gently for our minstrel brave. His story is an epic of our age. His story is an epic of our age. In books and movies evermore, he'll live this man who hated war. His story is an epic of our age. I know his face in heaven wears a smile. I know his face in heaven wears a smile. For he won't stop with this headline. He's writing for a new deadline. His wheat, his GI friends are Ernie Pyle.
George Ramsby's tribute to Ernie Pyle on the April 18, 1953 broadcast of the Saturday Night Party over Chicago radio station WBBM, commemorating the 8th anniversary of Pyle's death. This is Echoes of a Century, I'm King David McKenzie. Ernie Pyle was arguably the most beloved author of the first half of the 20th century, for the reasons that Ramsby touched upon in his piece. On the 2nd of November 1943, as part of their Words at War series, the NBC network broadcast a dramatic adaptation of material from one of Pyle's most popular books, This Is Your War. Santos Ortega played Pyle in this broadcast.
Words at War presents Here Is Your War by Ernie Pyle. I haven't written anything about the big picture of the war because I don't know anything about it. I only know what we see from our worm's eye views. Tired and dirty soldiers who are alive and don't want to die. Long, darkened convoys in the middle of the night. Silent men wandering down the hill from battles. Chow lines and foxholes and burning tanks. And the rustle of high-flown shells. Jeeps and petrol dumps and smelly bedding rolls. Sea rations and cactus patches. And blown bridges and dead mules and hospital tents. And shirt collars greasy black for months of wearing. Laughter and anger and wine. Lovely flowers. And constant cussing. And graves. And graves. And graves. This is our war. And we'll carry it with us as we go from one battlefield to another until it is all over. Leaving some of us behind on every beach and every field. They died, and thereby the rest of us can go on and on. When we leave here for the next chore, there is nothing we can do for the ones beneath the wooden crosses, except perhaps to pause and murmur, "Thanks, pal."
Words at War, brought to you by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the Council on Books in Wartime, brings you another in this series of radio adaptations of outstanding war books. Tonight, stories of the American campaign in North Africa, as reported in the new book, Here Is Your War, by the famous correspondent, Ernie Pyle. Soon after the first American troops landed in North Africa, millions of Americans here at home came to know for the first time a man named Ernie Pyle. Millions had known him, of course, in peacetime for his stories of the little things and the interesting people he met on his wanderings around the United States. But now, his dispatches from North Africa brought him a vastly wider audience of mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers and sweethearts who wanted to know what was happening to their soldier. Ernie Pyle told them. For Ernie, a slight friendly fellow of 40 years and about 140 pounds, had appointed himself the biographer of the GI soldier. He lived with this soldier, spent furloughs with him, ate and slept with him in the field, and followed him into battle, and wrote about him for the folks back home. These are some of the stories he has written, in the words of Ernie Pyle.
Stood at the rail of our troop ship at an English port and watched the troops march aboard. They came through the rain, heavily laden, steel helmets, overcoats, carrying rifles and huge packs, and rumors about where they were going.
You got any idea, Ernie?
About what, Sergeant?
About where we're going.
No, they didn't tell me.
I got an idea. Maybe we're going to Russia by way of Murmansk.
Oh, I don't figure it that way, Sergeant.
No?
How do you figure it, Corporal?
Well, I figure it's Iceland.
No, they don't need any more troops in Iceland. What do you say, Ernie?
I shouldn't think so, Sergeant.
Hey, look, Mr. Pyle, maybe we're going back to America, huh?
Say, are you nuts?
Well, it ain't impossible.
Listen, you think they shipped us all the way over here just to ship us back again? You're crazy. Hey, you, soldier.
Oh, me? Yes, Sergeant?
What's that you got?
Well, men who were going
shirt?
Off to war, they mean, carried Sergeant, odd things aboard. Some had books in their hands. Some carried violin or banjo cases. One soldier led a big black dog. And one I found out
don't
later carried two puppies under his shirt.
Dogs on this ship?
What do you mean, Sergeant? What dog?
The British. Ours was a British ship. Now, finicky about allowing dogs and troop transports. All dogs were ordered turned in. But somehow the morning we filed off the boat in North Africa and began the long march to our quarters, a big black dog and two little puppies from England marched with us up the strange African road. They came aboard silently, most of them. Now and then, one would catch sight of somebody he knew at the rail, and there would be a shout. It was a thrilling sight. And a sad sight, too, in a way, to see them marching in endless numbers up the steep gangway to be swallowed up by the great ship. After some time out, rumor-mongering was rife again. And one officer made up a rumor to the effect that we were going to Casablanca and timed it to see just how long it would take to circle the ship. It came back to him as cold fact, right from the bridge, in just half an hour. I believe you could take any 1,000 soldiers in our army and out of them get many good entertainers. From the troops aboard our ship, they dug up an accordionist, a dancer, and a cowboy singer. They rehearsed every afternoon. And the big night came a couple of evenings before we got to Gibraltar. They put on two shows that night for the enlisted men only. But word got around, and the officers and nurses wanted to see it. So the night we were approaching Gibraltar, they cleaned it up some and put it on again.
Hey, take it off!
The show went over terrifically. There was genuine talent in it. But the hero of the evening was a hairy corporal, Joe Comita of Brooklyn, who did a strip tease. Joe twirled and stripped. Twirled and stripped. And then when he was down to his long, heavy GI underwear, he swung to the front of the stage, lifted his veil, and kissed the front row colonel right on the top of his bald head. The show was pretty good. But there was something more to it than just that. There was the knowledge, deep in everybody's mind, that this was our night of danger. Just brought word that Germany's entire U-boat pack was concentrated in the approaches to Gibraltar. More than 50 submarines were said to be waiting for us. I doubt that there was a soul aboard who expected the night to pass without attack.
Kyle?
Yes, Major?
That's a wonderful thing. Those boys putting on that show up there when they're being taken to war like galley slaves down the hold. When you think of some people at home squawking their heads off because they've got to do without little things, that makes my blood boil.
Outside, the air was warm and the moon laid a brilliant sheen across the water. By its very gentleness, the night seemed in collusion with the evil that lay beneath the waters. It was a perfect night for romance. Or for death.
Where seldom is heard.
We rode it through with laughter, music, and a song. Finally, we reached our port. Slowly and intricately, like twine from a hidden ball, the ships poured us onto the docks in long brown lines. We lined up and marched away. Some of us marched 3 miles, some of us 20 miles. We marched at first gaily and finally with great weariness, but always with a feeling that at last we were beginning the final series of marches that would lead us home again. Home. The one really profound goal that obsesses every American marching on foreign soil.
Hello.
give time our first taste of action. Each man was issued 3 bars of D-ration chocolate, enough to last 1 day. He took no other food. He carried 2 canteens of water instead of the usual 1. And the day that followed, he lived in a way that is inconceivable to anyone who hasn't experienced it. He walked and fought all night without sleep. Next day, he huddled in a foxhole, a hidden fields of green, knee-high wheat. The German fell for him continually with his artillery. He frankly didn't like it much.
I wish it wasn't night.
Won't be any picnic tonight.
Anything's better than just laying here. Listen to that doggone artillery. Can't they shut up for a little while?
Don't seem like
I wish they'd shut up. That's what I wish. I just wish they'd shut up.
A man can't see a shell unless he's standing near the gun when it's fired. But its rush through the air makes such a loud sound. You wouldn't believe it couldn't be seen. Some shells whine. Others make a kind of toneless rustle. It's hard to describe. The nearest I can come to it is the sound of jerking a stick through water. Some apparently defective shells got out of shape and made queer noises. I remember one that sounded like a locomotive puffing hard at 40 miles an hour.
Would they ever shut up? Just for a minute? Shut up! Shut up!
Down, you crazy...
We were shot at by 88s, 47s, machine guns, tanks. And despite our own air superiority, we were dive-bombed by surprise. But the Germans were always in such a hurry to get it over and get home that usually their aim was bad and the bombs fell harmlessly in open spaces. Of course, you couldn't depend on that. But strangely enough, although there's nothing lighthearted about the imminence of death at the moment it's upon a man, sometimes it can seem very funny next morning.
Say, I hear there's one man who says he wasn't scared last night.
Yeah, who's that, Sarge?
I don't know, but I'm going to find him and shake his hand, and I'll knock him out, the dirty liar.
You weren't scared, were you, Sarge?
Me? I was never so scared in my life. As soon as those bombs started dropping, I started hunting up a chaplain. Boy, I needed some morale building.
Actually, the reaction of American soldiers to their first bad bombings were exactly what you'd expect of them. They took it in a way to make you proud. Let's say there was a camp of 5,000 men and they went through a dive bombing and machine gun strafing. One man out of that 5,000 might break completely. 25 might lose their heads and run around foolishly. A couple of hundred would decide to change trenches in the middle of the bombing, forgetting that the safest place was the trench where they were in the beginning. But the 4,774 others would stay right in their trenches, thoroughly scared, but in full possession of themselves. And the moment it was over, they would be out with shovels and tools, helping to put out fires, working as calmly as ever they did in their jobs at home. Speaking of home, the mail from home caught up with us now and then. There'd be long intervals without any mail at all. Then suddenly, an avalanche.
Hey, look at Jablonski here. He's got 75 letters.
Yeah? Hey, Jablonski, how about letting me read some? I didn't get nothing.
Gorman, I see you drew something.
Yes, I did, too. I noticed that a friend of mine is sending me a magazine subscription and a mimeograph letter describing a church festival in my hometown. Wonderful, isn't it?
Well, better than nothing.
Hey, listen to this one I got. A letter from a rubber company telling me I ought to conserve my time. How do you like that?
Everybody felt really sorry for Private First Class Jim Blake.
Oh, my gosh, this is terrible. What am I going to do? What am I going to do?
What's the matter, Blake? You got all kinds of mail there.
All kinds of mail? Sure, look at it. 50 letters. 50 letters from my wife.
50 letters? From your wife? What's the matter with you? You ought to be jumping up and down. Hey, listen to the guy. He gets 50 letters from his wife and he's crabbing.
Hey, wait a minute. Wait a minute. You don't get it. This is terrible. It's awful. It puts me in an awful jam.
The guy gets 50 letters and he's squawking. I don't get it.
Oh, now listen. Will you listen? Here's what happened, see? I don't hear from my wife for 3 months, you see? She promised me that she'll write me twice a week. Okay, I don't hear from her for 3 months. I get sore, see? I write her and tell her she's let me down. I tell her we're all washed up. I tell her, go ahead, get a divorce.
Yeah?
Hey, that's bad, Blake.
And now I get 50 letters. The poor kid's been writing 4 letters a week. Only they just catch up with me. The poor kid, what am I going
to
do?
See, Blake, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, that's tough, Blake. But look, maybe she didn't get your letter about the divorce yet.
Yeah, maybe you could send her a cable and say it was just a gag.
But those were rare respites, for the battle would not wait. And battle meant the infantry. I love the infantry. It's because they were the underdogs. They had no comforts, and they learned to live without the necessities. And in the end, they were the guys without whom the Battle of Africa could not have been won. The men were walking slowly, for they were dead weary. Every line of their bodies spoke their inhuman exhaustion. On their shoulders, they carried heavy steel tripods, machine gun barrels, leaden boxes of ammunition. There was an agony in your heart, and you felt almost ashamed to look at them. They were just guys from Broadway and Main Street. Their world can never be known to you. But if you could have seen them just once, you'd know that no matter how hard people were working back home, they never kept pace with those infantrymen in Tunisia. We talk sometimes during the lulls. Talk about home, mostly.
When do you figure the war will be over, Ernie?
I don't know. It's hard to say, Snip.
This year, maybe?
No, I hardly think so, Riley.
I sure wish it was over. Hey, maybe it will be over in 1944, huh, Ernie?
Maybe.
Boy, I sure want to get home. Back there in Idaho, where there's open country. I like open country, where if you want to holler, you can get out and holler. I don't care about hollering. I'd like to get back on my job.
What was your job, Riley?
Oh, I was kind of a carpenter. But my specialty was cabinet work. Oh, that's what I like. When a house is all done on the outside, I like to start inside and build cabinets and tables. I'm going to be a cabinet worker when I get back.
What did you do, Snip?
I drove a bakery truck. Sometimes I'd drive 180 miles a day making deliveries. You know, sometimes I'd make as high as $60 a week on that bakery route.
That's good money, Snip.
Oh, I'd make that doing cabinet work. Might even make more than that. Well, $60 a week would be okay for me. Of course, I don't plan on driving that bakery truck specially.
What do you plan on, Snip?
Oh, I don't know. Might do any number of things. Lots of things to do in Idaho.
It's a great place.
Say, Ernie, do you like to hunt?
Well, I guess I...
Well, listen now. When the war's over, will you come hunting with me in South Carolina?
Hey, you let me take you fishing before you do that. I'll show you some fishing that... Hey, watch out!
Say, you ever been deer hunting in South Carolina, Ernie?
No, I haven't.
Well, you know what they do to the first man to miss a deer?
What's that, Ron?
They cut his shirt tail off.
What for?
I don't know. It's just a custom there.
Boy, if I live through this, I'm going to do me some real fishing when I get home.
War coarsens most people. Men live rough and talk rough. If they didn't toughen up inside, they simply wouldn't be able to take it. An officer friend of mine told me of an incident that touched him deeply. During a battle, he and a fellow officer came up to a tiny farmhouse. And just to be on the safe side, they called before entering.
Anybody in there? Who's in there?
Who's in there?
I'm in here, and who wants to know?
Oh, well, I'm Lieutenant Brown, sir, and this is Lieutenant Kruger. May we come in?
Do what you please.
Captain, we won't be in your way.
You won't be in my way, and I'm heating up some rations. Hope you got some of your own.
Yes, we have, sir. May we throw our bedding down over here?
Put it where you like.
Thank you, sir.
Watch out for that man over there.
Huh? Oh, I didn't see him, sir. Oh, he's wounded.
He's dead.
Sir, I happen to have this bottle here. Would you join us in a drink?
What?
Will you have a drink, sir?
Drink? Have you got enough from my man outside?
Why, no, sir. Just what's here.
No, thanks.
War Corson's people. My own emotions seemed dead and crusty when presented with the tangibles of war. I found I could look on rows of fresh graves without a lump in my throat. Somehow I could look on mutilated bodies without flinching. It was only when I sat alone, away from it all, thinking, that at last the enormity of those newly dead struck like a living nightmare. There were times when I felt I couldn't stand it and would have to leave. But in the fighting soldier, that phase of the war was behind. He was left behind after his first battle. His blood was out. He was fighting for his life, and killing became as much a profession to him as writing was for me. He was truly at war. And yet... And yet the same frontline soldier was quite a different fellow in the towns and villages. More often than not, he gave all his rations away to the scrawny Arab kids and then had to live on oranges and tangerines himself. The Arab kids were friendly, and our soldiers weren't 2 days in a new place until every kid in town could say in English, chocolate, chewing gum, okay, and goodbye.
Wait a minute, you guys. Wait. Anybody got any candy or gum?
Oh, I haven't got a thing.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Sonny. We're all out of gum and chocolate.
Okay.
Gee, we're mighty sorry, Sonny. Well, hey, what are you crawling around in that dirt for?
Yeah, come on, Sonny, get up. You're dirty enough without crawling in it.
On your feet, pal.
Hey, wait a minute, Jack.
What's the matter?
This kid can't get up.
Say, the poor kid has to crawl. He must crawl all over town like that.
Chewing gum?
Yeah. Yeah, chewing gum, Sonny. We'll find you some chewing gum. Come on, up you go.
Okay.
They got him some chewing gum, and more than that. They took this terribly crippled Arab back to their airdrome. They took the wheels off a battery carrier and made a little wheeled platform for the kid to lie on. Now he rolls along the streets instead of crawling in the filth. And every soldier is his friend.
Okay. Chewing gum? Chocolate? Okay. Goodbye.
Yes, war coarsens people. But it can't harden the hearts of American boys. For all the killing they must do so that there'll be an end to killing. I don't think that any of us who have seen the mass cruelty of war can ever be cruel to a living thing when this war is over. And what of your soldier?
I'm just the same as I always was. I'm no different.
But he is different. The men over here in North Africa have changed. They're too close to themselves to sense the change, perhaps. But they have changed in little ways. Once, soldiers inevitably asked me two questions wherever I went.
When's the war going to be over, Ernie?
When do you think we'll get home, Ernie?
It's different now. Sure, they all still want to go home. But there is something deeper now. It isn't a theatrical proclamation that the enemy must be destroyed in the name of freedom.
Just that we've got to win this war or else. We can't be running excursion steamers back and forth across the Atlantic while we're doing it.
They're rougher than when you last saw them. War's a rough business. Money means little to them right now. They spend it freely or give it away. And they're dead sure of one thing.
Boy, if I ever get home, I'm going to stay home. I never want to see a foreign country again. I don't want to even hear about a foreign country.
But down in their hearts, they know full well.
Yeah, I bet you won't be home 6 months before you start going around talking Arabic, bragging about that girl you met in England, huh? Telling about the beautiful sunset you saw in Germany.
Oh, me? Why, you... Yeah, I guess that's just about what we'll all be doing.
You'll know them all right. They'll snap back into the ways of peace, just as they snapped into the ways of war. Meanwhile, they're well cared for. No soldiers in any other war in history have had such excellent attention. They're a healthy army. Their food is good.
Boy, what I wouldn't give for a swell steak in a Broadway restaurant.
He's thinking more of Broadway than the steak. He's thinking more of home, wherever home may be. Thank you. Finally, the campaign was over. Now we're in a lull. Here, where I'm writing these words, the Mediterranean surf caresses the sandy beach not 100 yards away and is a lullaby for sleeping. The water is incredibly blue, just as we always heard it was. The sky is a cloudless blue infinity. The only sounds are the birds singing in the scrub bushes that grow out of the sand and lean away from the sea. Now, there's a little time to rest. Time for a cigarette and peace. For music and a song. And under this cloudless sky, by this blue sea, there are the rows of white crosses that we must leave behind as we start for another battlefield. As we start another march. Feeling as we always feel, that this is the march that will lead us home. Home. The one goal of every American who marches on foreign soil.
Where seldom is heard a discouraging word, and the skies are not cloudy.
There'll always be some left behind as we go from one battlefield to another. They die, and thereby the rest of us can go on. There is nothing we can do for the ones beneath the wooden crosses, except perhaps to pause and murmur, "Thanks, pal."
As the 21st program of Words at War, we have brought you passages from the new book by Ernie Pyle, Here Is Your War, adapted for radio by Gerald Holland of the NBC staff. Ernie Pyle was played by Santos Ortega. Others in the cast were Harry Belliver, Humphrey Davis, David Gothard, John Griggs, Gerald Keane, Richard Keith, Alastair Kyle, Billy Redfield, Norman Rolls, and Bill Zucker. The original music was composed and conducted by Morris Mamorski, and the production was under the direction of Joseph Losey. Next week, Words at War will present Lieutenant John Mason Brown in a dramatic adaptation of his brilliant forthcoming book, To All Hands, which he calls an amphibious adventure. Words at War is brought to you in cooperation with the Council on Books in Wartime by the National Broadcasting Company and the independent radio stations associated with the NBC network. This program came to you from New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
A dramatization of material from Ernie Pyle's This Is Your War, as heard over the NBC network on November 2, 1943. This is Echoes of a Century. I'm King David Mackenzie. On the 18th of April, 1945, Ernie Pyle was killed by a Japanese army sniper on a tiny island off Okinawa. To the soldiers of the United Nations fighting the Axis at the time, it was a bitter blow, as NBC correspondent Robert McCormick explained in this partly personal report from Guam late that day.
Robert McCormick at Advanced Fleet Headquarters in Guam. The news of Ernie Pyle's tragic death hit every man on Guam like a club tonight. And I mean every man, from the high officers to the lowliest GI. Most of the correspondents here didn't get to see much of Pyle when he was around. He spent most of his time getting material for his column and then actually writing it. He had little time for the minor recreations we indulge in. He was working, and he considered his work of representing the GIs in the war
almost a crusade. In spite of the fact that he was one of the most famous men in America, Pyle was a lonesome person. I'd known him probably longer than anyone else out here. He was writing a column on aviation in the Washington Daily News when I went to work for that paper 15 years ago. A couple of years later, he became managing editor of the Washington News, and as such, one of my first bosses. Here at Guam, he was constantly trying to avoid the round of dinners and parties tendered him by the higher officers. He kept saying he wanted to get with the ordinary soldier, marine, and sailor, not with the generals and admirals. And he'd come around to my room every so often, in our Quonset Hut bachelor's quarters here, and he'd just sit and talk. He'd tell me how frightened he was in Europe when he was caught in such flaming horrors as the time we bombed our own lines in France. And he'd say he had hoped he'd never have to see any more combat. He said he always felt he would die in this war, die just the same sort of death he had described so often. He said he hadn't wanted to come to the Pacific. Naturally, we'd ask him, why then had he come? And he would say he felt it was his job to be here. He never pretended to be a fearless hero. He never pretended he liked shots and shell. As a matter of fact, he always said it terrified him, and that he'd never been able to adjust himself to the horrors and hardships of war. But he sincerely believed he had a duty to 11 million enlisted men, the duty of trying to tell Americans how they felt and acted during the worst days they'd ever go through. And while he felt this was his duty, nothing in this whole world could have persuaded him to go back home where he so much wanted to be. We don't yet know very much about how Pyle died. Apparently, it was almost a freak thing. The reports say only that it is regretfully reported that Ernie Pyle was instantly killed while standing with a lieutenant colonel commanding a regiment at regimental headquarters by surprise Jap machine gun fire on the outskirts of a town on Ieshima. It happened at 10:15 a.m. our time, or 8:15 p.m. the 17th of April, Eastern War Time. That should be the 18th of April. So, after watching the fighting through all the historic spots around the Mediterranean and in France, Ernie died in one of the most obscure actions of the war. Ieshima is a small island just off Okinawa, not a very important island, and desired by us only for the airports on it, airports which even the Japs were not using. Pyle is the second of the country's great newspaper men to die in the Central Pacific. The first was, of course, Ray Clapper, who was killed in an airplane crash in February of last year at the time we were invading the Marshalls. And it's ironic that Clapper and Pyle worked very closely together in the days when I knew them both. When Pyle was my boss on the Washington News, Clapper was head of the United Press Bureau in Washington, and the Washington News office adjoined the United Press office in an old building on New York Avenue in Washington. Later, Clapper became a columnist for the Scriptside Newspaper Alliance, the same organization for which Pyle started his career as a syndicated columnist. The thing that haunts those of us who knew Pyle well was his deep-seated conviction that he would die exactly the way he did. And his determination to go right ahead was what he conceived to be his duty, in spite of the fact that he considered it certain work. He kept at it, certainly not for money. He had little regard for money, and he told me he already had more than he needed or even wanted. He kept at it because he thought it was his job to keep at it. I guess that's what the Army and Navy mean by behavior in keeping with the highest traditions of the service. This is Robert McCormick at Guam, returning you to NBC in the United States.
In July 1945, the story of G.I. Joe, a movie dramatizing some of Ernie Pyle's writings, with Burgess Meredith playing Pyle, was released to almost universal acclaim. On the 29th of that month, on the Chase and Sanborn program over NBC, Francis Langford, Ken Carpenter, and Tony Romano discussed and recreated a scene from that movie.
About 10 days ago in Albuquerque, New Mexico, I had the privilege of seeing the world premiere of Ernie Pyle's story of G.I. Joe with Burgess Meredith as Little Ernie. Yeah,
I saw it too, Francis, in Hollywood. Pyle must have been a wonderful man.
He certainly was, Ken. Tony and I met him over in Sicily. Remember, Tony?
Gee, it seems like a long time ago.
It was outside the Palermo ballpark. Bob Hope, Tony, and I had just finished a show. It was a typical war meeting, much too short. Ernie was going one way, we were going the other.
Mm. Sounds like one of Pyle's own descriptions.
I take that as a great compliment, Ken.
You know, Francis, seemed to me they really captured Pyle's point of view by showing him as the soldiers knew him.
I think G.I. Joe definitely does that, Ken, and more. It shows how the foot soldiers felt about Ernie Pyle and the war they fought from El Guitar to Casino.
Casino. Rain, mud, and rocks. Krauts looking down your throat along a machine gun barrel. Yeah, you dug a foxhole in the side of a hill, bailed it out, and you crawled in. And foxholes all around you are your friends. Guys whose folks were Irish, Polish, Dutch, Jewish, Protestant, Catholic, Russian, Italian, Mexican, everyone in America.
Hey, you.
Yeah, who's that?
It is me.
Joe?
See.
What, are you lost?
No, I just don't know where I am.
Okay, crawl in here.
You got room?
You can't scrounge around out there. I'll make room. Come on, bail out some more water.
Muchas gracias. Hey, it is very wet, huh?
Yeah. In Africa, we didn't have enough water. Here we got too much.
I guess war is never perfect.
Mm. We'd have guessed about this when we was in Africa. Maybe we wouldn't have griped so.
Say, do you remember Africa? Some of those moonlight nights, they were not so bad compared to these.
Mm.
Sometimes at least we heard a little radio.
Yeah. There's Sally. Good old Sally talking sexy at us from Berlin. What a sweet voice she had.
Such a sweet voice. Saying such rotten things.
Who paid any attention to what she said?
Sometimes it made you think a little bit. You couldn't help it when she would whisper, "Hello, soldier. Lonesome? Wondering who's with your girl back home? There's a moon all over, you know. Why not surrender and come to Berlin? We know how to entertain strong young American men."
Yeah. And some guy holler, "Shut up."
But we did not turn her off because we wanted to hear her sing that song, that Linda. I like that.
Yeah.
Linda. If only my Linda were only here now instead of you.
Yeah, she'd love it.
Linda, I can close my eyes, and we are together back in Monterey. Linda, I say, Linda. Light for me a cigarette in that small cafe where we met. Let me feel your fingertips, Linda, Linda, on my lips. Where two lovers used to be, are there echoes waiting for me? And do you still wait for me too? As Linda, my love, I wait for you.
Tony, for the song G.I. Joe. I like your imitation of Sally, too. There is a small monument on the little island of Iwo Jima, a monument built by combat-saddened soldiers for a friend they loved and respected, Ernie Pyle. Those of us who were fortunate enough to know Ernie and who have seen him in action, those of us who saw how the fighting men of this war felt about him, well, we would like to have helped build that distant monument to Ernie's memory. But the friendly understanding Ernie Pyle gave our men all over the world and the patient courage with which he sought out and brought home to their families the stories of those men at war, these are Nerimel monuments. For Ernie Pyle will live forever through his writings about our fighting forces and in the picture G.I. Joe, which is made with reverent care to present Ernie as he really was. Yes, there's a small monument on the little island of Iwo Jima, a symbol of the greater one every combat trooper carries in his heart for little Ernie. Good night.
And that concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio, on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at this same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.